Shell is allowed to drill into the potential oil-bearing zones at the Berger J site.
Shell gets federal approval for starting drilling for oil in the Arctic Ocean. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 17th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a preschool in Bethel is closed indefinitely after vandals trashed the building.
All of the toilets were clogged, the water was left running. We had several smart boards that were torn off the wall.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for the fall 2015 semester for their business and counseling psychology undergraduate programs. APU offers affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support personal and professional goals. More at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Obama administration approved Arctic oil drilling today. KUCB's John Ryan reports.
The Interior Department gave final approval to Shell Oil to drill into oil-bearing rocks at the company's Berger J drilling site. The company has until late September to complete this summer's exploratory drilling. Megan Baldino is a Shell spokesperson.
Our plan is to make most of the time that we have in theater. And whatever we don't accomplish this summer, we could potentially put plans in place to finish in 2016.
Shell's Polar Pioneer rig began drilling on July 30th, but Shell couldn't get permission to drill into oil-bearing layers until its missing icebreaker and the well capping stack perched on its stern returned from the lower 48. Greg Julian is a spokesperson for the Federal Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement.
Now that the capping stack is on hand, Shell is allowed to drill into the potential oil-bearing zones at the Berger J site.
Federal inspectors have been living on board both of Shell's Arctic drill rigs for the past 2 weeks of shallow drilling.
Nothing noteworthy to report. Things are going smoothly.
That icebreaker, the Fenica, hit a rock on its way out of Dutch Harbor on July 3rd. It then sailed to Oregon for repairs. Greenpeace protesters swinging beneath a Portland bridge further delayed the Fenica. Environmentalists reacted with dismay to the Obama administration's announcement. The approval of Arctic oil drilling comes a few days after the president announced that his upcoming visit to Alaska would focus on his push to fight climate change. Annie Leonard is the head of Greenpeace USA.
Obama's relationship with climate is a little schizophrenic. It just simply doesn't make sense to recognize what a serious problem climate change is and then give permission for one of the most climate disastrous projects that I can imagine, drilling in the Arctic. You're either on one side or the other.
The president will visit Alaska at the end of this month. The White House video promoting Obama's trip as part of his legacy of leadership on protecting the climate did not mention his administration's support for Arctic drilling. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
The first U.S. Army Apache helicopters to be based in Alaska are scheduled to arrive at Fort Wainwright this week. They're part of a new unit that will include 24 helicopters and 400 soldiers. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
U.S. Army Alaska Aviation Task Force Commander Blake Alexander expects the first two Apache aircraft to be flown in aboard a large cargo plane as early as Tuesday. Alexander describes Fort Wainwright as well set up to base the Apache unit, adding that Interior Alaska will provide a unique testing and training environment.
It is absolutely the first winter testing. I will say that they have been stationed at Fort Drum, New York prior to this. But it's certainly not the subarctic that we're about to experience here. They've been tested in snow, but they haven't had skis on them before, so that's going to be a new step for us, supplying the skis that we use up here on our other aircraft to the Apache. That's a first. And then, of course, the temperatures when they drop below minus 20, I don't think that's been encountered before either.
The new task force replaces a similar one that used older Kiowa Warrior helicopters and demobilized from Fort Wainwright earlier this year. Alexander says the Apache offers updated technology and capability.
They have the ability to team with other Apaches and with the infantry soldier on the ground through laser designation capabilities. It's got the ability to shoot Hellfire missiles. It has a 30-millimeter gun, and of course the ability to shoot rockets. In addition to that, it's got some really good optics, so when we use it in the reconnaissance role, it will be able to reach out and see. This is a day-night capable aircraft. It's got the heat-seeking capabilities and sensing.
Alexander says the new aviation regiment is scheduled to stand up in September with delivery of all helicopters to Fort Wainwright by next April. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A legislative committee plans to meet Tuesday to discuss whether or not to challenge Governor Bill Walker's plan to expand Medicaid in Alaska. One point of contention is if the thousands of lower-income Alaskans who comprise the expansion population are a mandatory group for coverage or an optional group. The federal health care law expanded eligibility for Medicaid, but the U.S. Supreme Court in 2012 said states could not be penalized if they didn't participate in expansion. Some read the court's decision as meaning the expansion population is optional and that legislative approval is necessary for giving the group coverage. In July, Walker announced plans to accept federal money to expand Medicaid after legislators tabled his bill for further review. The targeted expansion rollout date is September 1st. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what would you do if you were governor for a day?
Do a dog race.
I'd build a gas line.
I would have more things like this, especially, and make sure that it's sunny out.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Vandals in Bethel smashed school district car windows and trashed preschool classrooms over the weekend. Lower Kuskokwim School District Superintendent Dan Walker says it appears people threw rocks at 13 cars parked near the district office. Inside the preschool, they made an absolute mess.
So all of the toilets were clogged. The water was left running. We had several smart boards that were torn off the wall, computers that were thrown off onto the floor, and then a few computers that are missing.
Preliminary estimates of the damage exceeded $50,000 for the vehicles and another $50,000 to the preschool. Bethel police are investigating. Walker is hopeful that the school's camera system can provide leads in the case.
Our technology folks are going through video footage right now. I will be surprised if we don't have some footage, and then the question is going to be whether we can identify people from that footage or you know, get an idea of who we need to talk to.
After starting up the new school year last week, nearly 50 families with preschoolers are now waiting again for school to start. Walker says there's no firm timeline.
So right now we've canceled classes until further notice. Probably later this week we'll have a better idea of if we will be able to get far enough along to get that building cleaned up to where we can have classes next week.
Before cleanup goes too far, Walker says his team needs to find out if the discharged fire extinguishers have made the air in the building too hazardous to breathe. He says the district can't simply move preschoolers to another classroom because the facilities have to be licensed. Walker says the district is looking at it adding additional outside lights and cameras as well. The Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Robert McDonald, traveled to Point Hope and Kotzebue last week to honor local vets and listen to their concerns. As KNOM's Emily Russell reports, remote access to care and information are some of the most common problems facing veterans in both communities.
Leonard Barger, Transportation Director of the Native Village of Point Hope, wrote to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Robert McDonald, last year, requesting a visit to honor the community's veterans. Barger explains the importance of McDonald's visit to the 49th state.
It's not just Point Hope, it's all over, like in Barrow, Point Lab, Inuklit, all over, all these people in Alaska, you know, they're going to Afghanistan. You know, they're leaving their family, but they're serving our country. They're sacrificing their lives for us.
With the highest number of veterans per capita in the country, even the most remote communities throughout Alaska have vets. Along with visiting Point Hope, McDonald also held listening sessions that day in Kotzebue. It took Walter Sampson, a Vietnam vet living in Kotzebue, 11 years to get service by the VA in Anchorage, a 500-mile journey and a $600 plane ticket away from home. Sampson made sure to remind McDonald of the unique challenges that many of Alaska's vets face in accessing the benefits they've earned.
Remember that we're in bush Alaska. We're in a roadless communities where Fairbanks, Anchorage has the clinics, they've got VA offices, they've got the hospitals, but for bush Alaska, we've got nothing at all.
Without the VA facilities and representatives, information has a hard time reaching vets in bush Alaska. Sampson expressed a feeling that many vets seem to share.
As a veteran, I ask myself, do I really know who VA is? What benefits does it have for me?
Sampson is frustrated by the convoluted nature of the VA support system, which often requires multiple phone calls, website logins, and, in the end, a system too complex for its own good. McDonald was quick to acknowledge those inefficiencies.
Walter's right. We've got too many 1-800 numbers. It's too confusing. We've got over 900 1-800 numbers. That's ridiculous. We have 14 websites that require different usernames and different passwords. We're going to go to one 1-800 number. We're going to go to one website. It's just too complex. We've got to simplify it. That's what we're working to do.
But a simplified system is only one step towards getting vets throughout Alaska the benefits they deserve. With McDonald gone and many questions left unanswered, the support that seems the most promising comes from within the state. Chester Ballett, another Vietnam vet in Kotzebue, was trained in Anchorage as a tribal veteran representative and now works to sign up fellow vets to the VA. The Alaska VA also sent two representatives to both Point Hope and Kotzebue to sign up and inform vets of their benefits. So far, the Alaska VA has sent representatives to 39 of the state's nearly 300 villages. Although McDonald is back in D.C., Leonard Barger hopes that this will not be his last visit to Point Hope. Barger and other community members encouraged him to return in the spring to take part in a whale hunt, one of the many benefits of living on the edge of the Bering Sea. Reporting from Point Hope, I'm Emily Russell.
Bill Walker hosted his first governor's picnic in Juneau on Friday at the University of Alaska Southeast. While he served up hot dogs and salmon, KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins asked picnic goers what they'd do as governor for the day.
The community lined up on a warm, sunny afternoon to mingle with state officials, but also for the free food, hot dogs, salmon, and locally made ice cream. Governor Walker was dressed for the occasion.
I'm wearing my cook outfit, my apron, my governor's picnic apron, and it's the third time I've worn this outfit.
He says it can be tough doing double duty, serving the public fillets of fish and being a politician.
My problem is this, I like to shake hands and say hello to people, and when I, you know, I have to wear a plastic glove, and I take it off, put it back on, take it off, put it back on.
Brenda Calkins and her daughter are waiting in line. They're inching closer to the governor, but not sure what they'll say when he serves them a piece of salmon.
I might have to think up a question in like 2 seconds. Yeah.
In years past, the governor's picnic has been held at Sandy Beach. This year, it's on the UAS campus to highlight education and kids' activities. A fire truck is parked nearby for children to hop on board. And like the food, there's a line for that too.
As soon as someone else leaves, you can get up in there. I just want to make sure there's enough space.
Volunteer firefighter Steven Anderson is making sure everything runs smoothly.
So you have a super important job.
Yeah, well, no, I've been doing about 5 years. As much as I can, I come out to the community events.
Well, I mean, this is important. You don't want kids to fall out of the fire truck.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's why I've got at least one guy on each side whenever I do this, just because I definitely don't want anything to happen to anybody.
And I've been asking everyone, if you were governor for the day, what would you do?
Kick back in the mansion. I mean, I don't know much about politics, so I don't think I can change much in a day, so. But governor for a day, I'd hang out in the mansion. Never been in there.
After thinking about it a few seconds, he says he'd work on increasing the firefighters' budget. At the event, the Thunder Mountain High School football team is also helping out.
Just kind of picking up trash, handing out flyers, and at one point we were helping people find a place to park.
Left tackle Josh Quinto has his own ideas about what he'd do if he was governor. It involves more community events.
Maybe throw a big party? I'd have different music every day, maybe some rock, country occasionally, some random stuff like Fall Out Boy or Nickelback, I guess. Definitely not the same food. Maybe other than salmon, I don't know, like halibut? Fish and chips, those are always good.
Picnic-goers lounge on a half-moon concrete bench, scraping food off plates and watching people play cornhole. And Dwellem Fanta is watching the fun. He travels for work with Delta Airlines.
I'm originally from Ethiopia, so I migrated to U.S. and
I lived in a different state, but this is my first time. The governor invited everybody and having a good time.
I ask, what would he do as governor?
If I'm a governor, today?
Just for a day.
Just for a day? Serve the people like this, you know. It would be a great opportunity, you know, to show you care about the people.
From everyone, there was a variety of unique responses.
Governor for a day. Let's see.
Do a dog race.
I'd build a gas line.
I would have more things like this, especially, and make sure that it's sunny out.
I didn't know you could make it sunny if you were governor. That's pretty awesome.
Some governors think so.
I catch up with Brenda Calkins and her daughter from before as they make it through the end of the food line. Unfortunately, Governor Walker ducked out for a photo op with a costume bear, but First Lady Donna Walker is still there.
And so it looks like you guys didn't get to talk to Governor Walker, but you got to talk to someone else.
Yes, we did. She was very nice.
Did you guys have any pressing questions for her?
What her husband looked like?
I didn't know it was a First Lady.
Which is what the governor's picnic is all about, getting to know your officials. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increase the earning power with a Bachelor of Business Administration degree with a Human Resource Management emphasis from the UAS School of Management. Details at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Southeast Dungeness summer crab season ended on Saturday. There aren't any preliminary numbers yet, but it's looking as if this year hasn't gotten even close to the bumper season fishermen had last summer. KFSK's Joey Sykes spent a couple of hours on a Petersburg crab boat unloading for the last time.
Crab fisherman Tor Benson is waiting to unload his final Dungeness catch of the season at Icicle's dock. It was a slow day, and while he says he's still making money...
It's getting to that point where next time we might not. Yeah, it's a good time to end.
Benson's boat reeks from the stench of rotting crab bait after a long day out in the Alaskan sun. And deckhand Leif Matten, cleaning bait boxes at the bow of the boat, says he's glad it's all over.
We're all jaded from last year, though. Last year was a great season. It's hard when you make that, you know, do that well, and then you come back and it's not so good.
Many crab fishermen say last summer will go down as legendary in the history of Southeast Dungeness fishery. Crabbers caught £4.06 million, earning a value of over $12 million. That was more than double what they earned in the 2013 season. And Benson says since fishing started in June, he's caught only about 30% of the crab he brought in last summer.
This year's slow. Last year, I mean, last year's an epic year, like best in a decade. So that's fishing. You have good years and you have bad.
But the numbers seem to show that rather than it being a bad year, the catch has returned to somewhere close to the average season yield. While the final week's fish tickets have yet to be entered, the crab harvest through August 13th for the 2015 season is £2.56 million, close to the five-year average of just over £3 million. And Joe Stratman, who's a crab biologist at Fish and Game, says irrespective of the slowdown...
Crab quality has been good. Crabs generally have been hard shell and full of meat.
And much of that meat has been caught by an expanded fleet. Stratman says because of the bumper harvest last year, the number of permits reporting catches is 192, almost 30 more than the average for the last 5 years. While many of these numbers are preliminary, it seems fishing hasn't quite lived up to expectations. And at Icicle's dock, a long, hard season has taken a toll on everyone. Juan works as an unloader at PFI and has dropped down from the factory to help take the crab up to be sorted for the final time.
Are you pleased the crab season is over?
Yeah, hey crabs.
No more.
And with that, he starts transferring the dungies into his tote. And another summer crab season scuttles swiftly to a close. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Sykes.
The Togiak National Wildlife Refuge encompasses almost 5 million acres in southwestern Alaska. Each year, a refuge staff organizes a high school science camp conducted via float trip to show area students a little sliver of the refuge in their backyard. Earlier this month, 6 students from Dillingham and Twin Hills floated the Pungiapuk River. KDLG's Molly Dishner tagged along as one of the chaperones and brought back this story.
Bristol Bay is known for fish, and the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge is no exception. During the high school float camp on the Pungo River, it was rainbows and resident species, not reds, that lured anglers to keep casting.
Woo! Man!
Wow!
Good day! Man, I should be tallying up what fish I get, because yesterday I got a pike.
That was Savannah Sage catching yet another rainbow, while refuge manager Susanna Henry rode our inflatable blue raft downstream. Prior to the trip, Sage had caught just one rainbow this summer, up at Lake Aleknagik. A day into the float, her tally was up to more than half a dozen and climbing. The river stretches 16 miles from Pungo Lake to the Togiak River. The sun was shining nearly the entire time we were on the water, and until the final day, a light breeze kept the bugs away. 16 miles might sound like a short trip, but there's enough fish in the Pungo to make every mile last. It took us 4 days, with plenty of stops for fishing. Drew Wassily caught his first rainbow ever on the trip, but he said it was his tentmate and fishing partner, Carlton Small of Twin Hills, who is the most prolific fisher.
He's the rainbow slaying machine.
On the last day of camp, Small says he had caught about 30 fish over the course of the trip. That doesn't include the smolt caught by the whole group. Campers set out minnow traps before bed on the first night, baited with bacon. The next morning, refuge education specialist Terry Fuller helped intern Connor Ito and the campers ID the smolt they found waiting for them.
Well, I've got a little bit of white and black, look.
Yes.
There is on the one.
Yeah, okay, so this is a silver.
So there are silvers to be found.
This is typical.
Camp wasn't just about catching fish. Students also put on a dry suit to snorkel with fish, and there were non-fishy activities too. Fire building, berry picking, a leave-no-trace activity, and hours on the river identifying plants and birds. But Ito, a former camper herself, offered perhaps the most important lesson of all, how to roast a Twinkie.
Now you want to very slowly roast the Twinkie until it is crunchy and golden brown on the outside more than it already is, and the filling is bubbling out of the holes at the bottom. Because that means that it's heated all the way through, and then you may eat the Twinkie.
The verdict?
I taste more buttery.
In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
A century ago, to hike to the Klondike goldfields via the Chilkoot Trail meant a grueling trek carrying a required 1 ton of supplies, enough to last a year. Soon, armchair hikers can breeze along the 33-mile trail virtually in a few minutes using Google's Street View. Greta Mart from KHNS has more.
Those planning on hiking the Chilkoot Trail might start with this informational video produced by the National Park Service.
Welcome to Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park, home to the famous Chilkoot Trail.
Hiking the Chilkoot can be highly rewarding. However, unlike many hikes, taking on the Chilkoot means crossing an international border and hiking 33 miles of isolated, physically challenging, and potentially hazardous terrain.
But soon, there will be another way to experience it. For the first time, Google Street View is going off-road in Alaska. This month, two Parks Canada staff mapped the entire Chilkoot Trail. They used a backpack-mounted camera system called the Google Trekker. Parks Canada and Google agreed to partner a few years ago in creating virtual tours of many of Canada's national and regional parks. The first Canadian park to appear on Google Street View was Nova Scotia's Fortress of Louisbourg in 2013, and more than 100 wild Canadian places have been added since. Klondike National Park Superintendent Mike Trunnell says Parks Canada approached the National Park Service last fall to see if managers here were interested in joining a project to map the Chilkoot. The Alaska segment of the trail is managed by the NPS, and Parks Canada manages the Canadian side. The trail starts in Dyea and snakes up the Taya River to Crater Lake and the headwaters of the Yukon River at Lake Bennett, British Columbia.
You can see it online. Do you still need to come and do it?
Trunell says the Park Service mulled over whether putting the trail online would result in more or fewer visitors coming to hike the real thing. Currently, between 2,500 and 3,000 people hike the entire trail each year.
You know, I think in the end it will end up being good publicity for the trail and a way for people to see what it's all about, what it looks like, and I think it will spur more interest in coming to hike the trail.
Parks Canada spokesperson Christine Aiken says they wanted to create a virtual tour of the Chilkoot and other wild places so that people will better understand why these places are so special and encourage in-person visitation. Trunell says mapping the Chilkoot with the heavy camera equipment was a challenge for the Parks Canada team. It was key to keep the camera level and correctly oriented, especially on the difficult Golden Stairs section. During the first week in August, the weather cooperated and the mapping hike was on. Trunell says he's excited about the street view mapping because it'll pave the way for a more detailed project in the works, an 1898 street view version of the trail. Using archaeological data and historical photographs and maps,
we can potentially recreate what it would have looked like to travel over the trail in 1898 during the gold rush. And so that's something that I think would be really cool. And the doing the Google Street View of the 2015 view of the trail, it can help us with our ability to do that 1898 Google Street View idea.
Parks Canada says people can expect to see the trail on Google Maps in the coming months. In Haines, I'm Greta Mart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Emily Russell in Nome, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Joe Sykes in Petersburg, Molly Dishner in Dillingham, and Greta Mart in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a fantastic evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for the fall 2015 semester for their business and counseling psychology undergraduate programs. APU offers affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support personal and professional goals. More at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.